Thank you for joining me. I'm Julie Vecchio, and this is the Fisheries Podcast, a weekly podcast that shares the stories of the amazing people and projects that make up fisheries science. If you haven't already, follow the podcast on Twitter at Fisheries Pod, on Facebook at facebook.com/fisheriespodcast, or support the podcast on patreon.com/fisheriespodcast. If you're interested in showing off your support for the show or a favorite fish species, please check out our merch over at the Fisheries Podcast Fan Shop hosted by Teespring, where you can find t-shirts, hats, stickers, and more. I'm wearing my t-shirt today. Look for the link in the show notes. This week, my guest is Dion Kerr. Dion is a 2020 Bowling Green State University alum. He graduated with a BA in aquatic biology and a minor in environmental science. He spent the last 2 years working in Jeff Miner's aquatic ecology lab. The Miner lab served a crucial role in his development into an aspiring fisheries biologist. They provided him with hands-on fieldwork and gave him the opportunity to conduct an undergraduate research project focused on larval walleye drift dynamics in the Sandusky Bay. He currently works as a technician at The Ohio State University and is stationed at Ohio's Division of Wildlife Sandusky Fisheries Research Station, located in Sandusky, Ohio. He'll be leaving the Midwest in December to move to Clemson, South Carolina to pursue a master's degree at Clemson University. Welcome to the podcast, Dion. I'm so happy to talk to you today.
Yeah, thanks, Julie. Thanks for having me today. It's a pleasure to be here.
I'm really excited to hear more about you because your voice has been part of the show and on our feed several times before, because you are one of the hosts of the Fisheries Diversity and Inclusion podcast, and we'll get back to that a little bit later. But I'm excited to hear more about sort of your background and what got you interested in fisheries in the first place.
Yeah, I'm excited to tell you all about my story and kind of going to the Fisheries Diversity podcast. It's crazy to just think that, I guess, myself, I'm relevant. I give the kudos to my lab mate. So he just kind of just came to me out of the open, was just like, hey, well, we were talking over the phone, and then just about, you know, typical, I guess, equality topics or philosophy type things. And he's just like, you know what? I love how you talk about these things. You want to like do this podcast with me? And I was just like, honestly, yeah. I love being able to just hopefully help or maybe change some minds if possible. So
moving way back, I always love to hear about folks' origin stories in fisheries. When did you know that you wanted to study fisheries or fish or the outdoors or something of that nature?
Yeah, so growing up, I've always been drawn to nature, and I've always loved, I guess, observing nature. So I really kind of started with birds, and then my dad took me fishing when I was 8. For the first time, and we went to a state park. It was East Harbor State Park, and that's in Marblehead, Ohio. We ended up catching a bunch of bullheads, and that was pretty much my first fish I've ever caught. And from there, I was addicted to fishing and fish for the most part, and that kind of just added to my my interest in the outdoors. But as far as getting into fisheries, we would need to fast forward way into my college life. So when I was going to Bowling Green, I originally wanted to major in aquatic biology, but I kind of just shied away because I didn't think I was smart enough, essentially. But after my first year, I was convinced to change my major going into my sophomore fall semester. I started going down that path, and I still didn't really know what fisheries was, though. I eventually met up with Dr. Miner. I just sent him an email one day. I was just like, hey, and this was like my junior year, and so I sent him an email. I was told he was the fish guy, and he was just like, yeah, you know, we can meet up at, you know, this afternoon. So I went and met up with Dr. Miner, and he's just, we just start talking about fisheries from there, and he's asking me, what do I want to do? And then he's explaining, you know, people who get degrees in this, you know, career field, they become fisheries biologists or ichthyologists. And I didn't really know what fisheries was until he finally explained it to me. So once I realized what the actual career is called and what that entails, that pretty much was set in stone. I knew what I wanted to do. So I would say I'm sort of blessed or fortunate there to be an undergrad and to fully know what I want to do. So I know a lot of people struggle there.
Absolutely, for sure. I actually didn't know that the field of fisheries existed or what it entailed until I did my master's degree. And in fact, I went to a program that was marine biology, and I really love this program because you could sort of sample various options before you decided on what thesis you were going to do. But when I found out what fisheries was, I was hooked, and that was close to 20 years ago now, and I have basically never stopped. So it's once you like figure out what it is, you're like, oh, this is amazing, right?
And that's the exact reaction I had. Like I see that amongst my peers. I mean, to those that just weren't in a lab at the time or might have been younger than me, they just didn't know. One thing I like to do is kind of put people on. So I was definitely informing them, because it's one of the things here, like at Bowling Green, is a part of that aquatic biology degree. And, you know, we're a Midwest school. Like their program is more heavily focused on marine biology. So
that's pretty funny.
Not many people are aware of the freshwater scene here in the Great Lakes. And they just really, by going that route, they're more focusing and learning about aquariums and things of that nature, and not necessarily fish management or agency work. So,
that's probably true. I went to undergrad in Michigan. And actually I have almost, very similar degrees to yours, and from undergrad in biology with an environmental science concentration, and also a BA, because the college that I went to actually did not confer BSs, which is also strange in a science. But anyway, I learned virtually nothing about the management of the Great Lakes, even though I was in a biology program in Michigan. And I have basically worked on, you know, the marine coast ever since. And I still know nothing about the management of the Great Lakes, although I know that it is huge and, you know, very involved and very interesting. I just don't know anything about it.
Yeah. And there's a ton of work to do in this area. So like anyone that's looking for a fisheries biologist position, or I guess one that's very active, especially throughout field season, you will definitely get that in a Great Lakes state.
Can you tell me a little bit more about working in Dr. Miner's lab? What was your favorite part about being an undergrad in a research lab?
Yeah, so for me, this is what I was craving, and working in the lab sufficed that, and that was getting the experience. So once I learned about fisheries, I knew what it was, but I didn't really know what the work experience entailed. So that was probably my favorite part about being an undergrad in a research lab, was actually learning how science or research works. Just how meticulous that work is, and I mean, learning the various techniques in fisheries, again, how to go about research, how to, you know, writing proposals and reading. I mean, that's one thing. To me, those are just things that I've never saw myself, I guess, doing, because one, I didn't believe in myself. And then two, I was just ignorant of the topic. So it was awesome to just firsthand experience all of that. And then I guess as a bonus, I did. I clicked really well with the lat with those graduate students. So like, we're all really good friends at this point. So that was like a bonus favorite
part.
Yeah,
that's great. And you got to help out with several grad student research projects.
Yeah. So at the time, Dr. Miner had three students. One of them I didn't do much work with. She was still figuring out her PhD work, so we didn't do much there. But the other two, one is doing work with Northern Pike, and the other one is focused on also larval wallet drift dynamics. So basically, I was able to help both of those guys out with their projects. And like Northern Pike work was usually mid-spring semester. And then the larval walleye stuff would take place like through the summer. So I was able to kind of work with two different sampling techniques. So that was nice.
Yeah, that's cool. Yeah, definitely getting a wide variety of different types of experiences is fantastic. Yeah. So tell me a little bit more about your thesis with the walleye and larvae.
So Bowling Green, BGSU, they have a funding program, I guess. So there's a CERS grant, and that acronym is College for Undergraduate Research Scholarships, so CURS. And you kind of have an undergraduate advisor that basically supports your application. And then as far as what that was focused on, that was centered around larval walleye. It was focused on drift a little bit, but it was mainly on dye-yield vertical migration.
Okay.
So from one of the references, actually a lot of the references are for this project and for larval walleye in general, there's not a whole lot. So we were able to branch off of what one of minor student that was focused on mainly the drift aspect, we were able to do a project on vertical migration. So essentially we had our treatment groups were day and night, and we were sampling from the surface and mid depth during each like time period.
Mm-hmm.
So basically we just wanted to see if they're vertically distributing themselves throughout the water column based on day or night. And during the daytime, surface sampling was virtually zero. And basically the majority of our fish we found were located mid depth or at depth. So come nighttime though, fish distribution was more homogeneous. Mm-hmm. So they were found at the surface and at depth still. But we definitely concluded that there is some migration happening. And from there, we started to look at, well, why are they migrating? So uh-huh. We were pulling dyads, my last semester. And then COVID hit and we had to stop.
Yeah, so I was going to ask you a few more questions about that. So this was new information. You didn't know where these larvae were going to be distributed for a walleye. I don't know anything about walleye life history at all. Mm-hmm. As I said before, I know nothing about Great Lakes fish, nothing about their life history. Are they spawning offshore in deeper water and then their juveniles are moving inshore? Is that a pattern?
It's actually, so it's the opposite. So, Yeah. So, you went to school in Michigan, but you might not know, I guess. Have you heard of the walleye run? Anything like that? Okay, so not to toot our own horn here, but Lake Erie in general has one of the best or the best walleye fisheries.
Mm-hmm.
And basically what happens, so every spring, and we're talking February, these adult walleye come in from the main lake. So they'll come into these tributaries like Sandusky Bay, which is where I did my sampling and where Chris is doing his sampling. Mm-hmm. They'll come into Sandusky Bay or the Maumee River or the Sandusky River, which are all tributaries to Lake Erie. They'll come in and spawn in rocky substrates and then essentially head back out, which when they leave, they kind of hang out in Sandusky Bay a little bit. And as the temperatures kind of warm up, the adults will begin to move more out to the main lake again, or out to, and out by the islands or so. But then as far as the larvae goes, we would actually, to know they're entering Sandusky Bay, we would sample the Sandusky River, which pours into Sandusky Bay, and then Sandusky Bay runs into Lake Erie. We would sample the river, and once we got larval fish in there, we know they're being pushed into Sandusky Bay. So you can pretty much start.
Once the larvae hatch, they're moving back offshore again?
They're pretty much being pushed out of that, out of the system.
Okay.
Because they're larvae, they can't, they are planktonic. So they can't control where, they can't just go where they want to go yet. But because of the hydrology or the hydrologic structure of the rivers in the bay, the water typically flows outward to the main lake. So eventually, those young of year walleye will get out of the bay and into Lake Erie.
Okay, got it.
Through hydrologic.
Yeah, so they're in rivers that are running pretty hard, and so then they just have to go where they're going.
Yeah.
In our system, in this area, it's actually pretty interesting. There's some amount of evidence that they definitely can control their depth, and then they use the tidal fluctuations to their advantage.
Okay.
So a lot of fish will spawn, like red drum is one that's really common. It spawns right at the mouth of bays, and then the larvae, they have enough control that they can control their depth, and then they can use the tides to get themselves where they need to be.
Gotcha.
But in a system like yours, where you have a river that's running one direction constantly, you don't really have that kind of advantage.
Yeah, no, for the most part. Like, we do have lake seshes. But I mean, that could delay how long they stay in the Sandusky Bay, because so, like, I guess keep in mind too, as far as walleye life history works. So yeah, they come in and spawn and hatch, and then they begin, you know, this drift period out to the main lake. But during that period, well, I guess I should say the walleye are the first ones on the scene. So
they
spawn first and they hatch first. Okay. And then following them is the yellow perch, and then your Moroni, so your white bass and white perch. And that's essentially, it's basically a competition at some point on who's going to get the biggest, the fastest. But the walleye in general are much larger than all three of those other fish species. And because they hatch first, they're kind of ahead of the game. So they're able to, once they hit around 30, what we found around the smallest fish we found was 17 millimeters, and that had larval fish in its gut. While they're basically in those tributaries,
they're just mowing down.
Well, I mean, once they hit 30 mil, it's lights out.
The vertical distribution and the vertical migration is really interesting in the lake as well. I mean, that's commonly known within the marine habitat, right? Yeah. Is the diurnal vertical migration, that everybody spends their day down low because there's not as much light, and then they come up and have a big, you know, eating party at nighttime when there's less possibility of being seen. But that's really interesting to see that in that kind of dynamic playing out in the lake as well.
Yeah. So, and then, you know, the biggest thing to take from that was Chris, the majority of his PhD was, you know, taking place, his sampling took place during the daytime and at the, like I said, the upper portion of the water column. So it kind of asked the question, you know, are you actually missing out on data? Is your data underrepresented because the majority of fish during the day are hanging out at, you know, mid depth or the bottom of the water column. So,
yep.
Yeah. And that also can apply to fish management or air agencies too, that, you know, mm-hmm. if they're doing their sampling, should they consider sampling at nighttime at the surface or whichever depth they prefer, or if they sample during the daytime, should they sample, you know, at depth?
Yeah, definitely. I actually have a friend who's defending soon, whose whole dissertation was modeling the depth dynamics of various larval fish species in our region here in the Gulf of Mexico and the Eastern Gulf of Mexico. So yeah, definitely a good question to be asking. And, you know, where are you actually finding these fish and where would you expect to find them?
Right. Yeah.
Very cool. So you are currently a technician with The Ohio State University and the Ohio DNR in Sandusky. I will just go ahead and show my ignorance to tell you that the only thing that I know about Sandusky, Ohio is Cedar Point. I made many trips to Cedar Point as a kid.
Well, I'm very proud of that.
And seeing the lake from the top of the roller coasters was quite nice.
Yes. So one of the things, I don't know if you've ever seen this, but it's like a screenshot of a tweet, and it's like a conversation, and it says like, it's like person, oh, where do you live? And it says me, and it's like, I'm from Sandusky, Ohio. And it's like, where's that? And then they're like, Cedar Point, like, oh yeah. And it's like, yeah, I'm from Cedar Point. And my house is on top of the top throw dragster. That's all you got to say is like, where's Sandusky? And you're like, you ever heard of Cedar Point? And like, oh yeah.
Yeah. Cedar Point, the largest amusement park in the country. I think that I was kind of spoiled living so close to there because nothing else can touch it for roller coasters.
I agree.
Seriously. This is all you guys have? Come on, man.
Yeah. And that's really how it is. Because it's the same way. I mean, living here, literally in the city it's at, and then you go to other amusement parks, and I mean, it kind of ruins the experience because you're just like, man, I literally lived with one of the greatest amusement parks in the world.
Yeah. So anyway, you don't work in the amusement park. What does your job entail there in Sandusky?
Yes. So as you stated, I am a tech funded through OSU. So my employment is through The Ohio State University. And I know the OSU kids want to hear the, so I had to add it in there. The OSU techs are stationed at a fishery station. So there's two in this area. There's the Sandusky one, which is the one I'm at. And then there is the Fairport office, which is located on the east side of Cleveland. And basically, we're techs, but we do have a bit more responsibility than, I guess, a boat tech. A typical year, the OSU tech will take command of one of our surveys. So we do a lower trophic level survey. And we pretty much collect water samples. It's nothing that crazy. I get we collect water samples for OSU, and that could be zooplankton samples, microcystin samples, phosphorus samples. But we hit various sites throughout the Western Basin. It would be nice to add that this office in Sandusky is responsible for the management of the entire Western Basin of Lake Erie. So they cover a lot of water. There's a lot of coverage and a lot of work to be done. So with this job, you are always helping out in the field with their surveys. Right now we're on the last survey that this office does, and that's walleye gill netting. So we are setting gill nets at various transects throughout the Western Basin, and that is to target walleye, yellow perch, and Moroni as well. But typically walleye is the target species here, and that is basically to have an index on age classes, or recruitment success. So once we catch the walleye, we'll pull the nets, bring them back, and then we'll work up those fish. And by working up, just taking their otoliths and a length, and all that gets entered into a database, and we can estimate ages, see which age classes are doing well, which had a poor recruitment, and so on and so forth. So there's a lot of field work, and you do have responsibility, I guess, outside of.
So it seems like over the last few years, you've done a lot of different types of field work and just really had your hands in a lot of different projects, which is fantastic. It's such a good experience. Do you have a favorite field memory so far?
Yeah. I think one of my most fond memories, man, we just definitely create another one. So during my undergrad experience, it was me and the two other grad students, Chris and Nate. We were sampling for Chris, and I can't remember why Nate came, but it's usually just Chris and I out there. And we, to sample for these larvae, we're pulling a Neustan net behind our boat. So we'll run, I believe, 6-minute transects. But when we were working up, we were bringing the net in. I was bending over to lift the frame up, and we pulled it in, and my butt knocked the throttle on the boat.
Oh!
It literally just pushed it practically to wide open. Just pushes it, just hammers it by accident. Oh. But Nate was like standing behind me, and he managed to somehow lunge forward and pull it back into neutral, or to like kill it. And I mean, that was scary.
Yeah.
It was just so funny. We just couldn't help to laugh. And he's like, dude.
So there's an Instagram account that's called The Qualified Captain. Have you seen this?
I haven't. Oh, I haven't. But I think my supervisor told me to look into it.
Yeah, it's pretty good. Well, recently there were actually the same video of two different angles of this like 50-something-year-old couple who were on pontoon boats, and the woman is sitting on her pontoon boat, like, which is kind of rafted up to another one right next to it, and the guy is standing on this other pontoon boat, and he's like leaning over and like proposing to her, and somehow one of them knocks into the throttle on her boat, and obviously it was on because it just like drove away. And he fell in and it crashed into the side of the lake, and like, what a disaster.
Oh, yes. That is a disaster. Thankfully we did not have to go through that, but man. Yeah, I was very surprised. I mean, we had plenty of open water to work with, but man, yeah, it was just really funny.
So your work in Ohio is coming to an end relatively soon, and your next move is going to be to Clemson, South Carolina, to attend Clemson University for your master's degree?
Yes. Yeah. So like you said, unfortunately, my job is coming to an end more or less in December. On the bright side, my next move is to head out of the Midwest to South Carolina. So
have you visited the mountains of South Carolina yet?
I have not. No. I mean, I've seen the mountains. I've visited North Carolina plenty, and I guess I've again seen the mountains, and I've done one small hike from my visits there. I loved it. I can't wait to move down there and get started for sure.
Fantastic. Who are you going to be working with?
So my advisor is going to be Dr. Troy Farmer, who is a He's a young lad. I think he's on his third year at Clemson now, third or fourth.
And, all right.
Yeah, he's awesome. I love him.
Nice.
Yeah, every experience I've had with him so far has just been very pleasureful. He's just a great guy to talk with. He's young, and he loves fisheries. He loves his work. He's got great ambition. So,
well, it's so good to have good mentors like that, for sure.
Yeah.
Do you know what your research project is going to be about?
It'll be a project, acoustic telemetry project, centered around measuring largemouth bass habitat use. So with these inland reservoirs, in the south, once they hit a certain age, I think it's called shoreline development. But the issue is these reservoirs get old, and their shoreline structure becomes compromised, or it becomes bad and not stimulating for, I guess, fish use. So South Carolina DNR has decided to implement artificial structures in these coves to help assist the habitat degradation that's taking place. So my job essentially is to capture some largemouth bass. So it'll actually be 40, and then tag 40, release them, and then basically work with the acoustic array to measure habitat use. And then the habitats that they are putting in do vary. So there's rocky structures, wooded structures, things like that. So it's kind of to help determine which habitats are the best and I guess where they should go. So,
okay, cool. Yeah. Well, we will look forward to having you back to tell us a little bit more about what you found in a while.
Yeah. Yep.
Very cool. Yeah. You've already started one project through Clemson. That's the Fisheries Diversity and Inclusion podcast that we had talked about a little bit at the top of the show. Is there more that you want to tell us about that effort and sort of why you're involved?
So we briefly talked about it earlier. You know, I almost want to say it's out of character for me, the fisheries diversity, like being a part of that, because I mean, as much as I love helping people, I guess, and treating people fairly or teaching people about treating people fairly, it was very spontaneous. And at some point, I think it's an extroverted thing to do, and I'm very introverted. it was definitely just a decision I made spontaneously when Aaron asked, but I appreciate being a part of it. And as far as that podcast goes, our biggest goal out of it is to simply educate others and to bring issues that exist to light, so people know about them, because being able to know they exist can help change minds. So that's what we're after, essentially. We don't claim to be experts, but we do feel that we can help in making people feel included and teaching people about treating them fairly in the workspace.
I do have to disagree with you, though, about hosting a podcast as an extroverted effort. I find it to be like literally the only way that I can talk to people. So
yeah, I feel it. I mean, we are behind a screen, and
a screen. You may or may not even have video. That's why I'm fine with not having video. I have a script. Like, I know what I'm going to ask you. It's not like I'm just like in a conversation with you. Mm-hmm. I have to like figure it out. Like,
Well, and that's so our most recent podcast, which is up, which everyone should check out, with Ernie Muhammad. He's a black fisheries biologist located in Charleston. That was live with video. So, I mean, there was really no, Aaron was basically getting that. It's going to be minimal editing. And I mean, he was really nervous.
Yeah.
But I guess I can agree with you on it being introverted. I mean, it's, we're just having a conversation at some point, but that was definitely.
To me though, just like having spontaneous conversations is one of like my biggest fears. And
yeah,
if I can like sit down with your resume and like figure out what I'm going to talk to you about, then I can talk to you for an hour. Yeah. I actually lived in Charleston for close to 3 years and barely learned about the Gullah Geechee culture. And I I want to learn more about it. And I definitely need to listen to that show too.
I've never heard of the Gullah Geechee until Ernie brought it up.
Mm-hmm.
And that is, I 100% will be taking a trip back to Charleston to just look into that. I mean, he said it, the way he described it was amazing. And I hope this isn't a bad reason, but he also mentioned the food being top notch. So, I was told that, you know, the Deep South is still very, you know, segregated for sure.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. When I go to North Carolina at some point, I don't really feel like I'm in the South because I guess, I don't know, suburbia feels like there is a mixture of black and white people there.
Right.
Like it just doesn't feel, it doesn't feel separated by any means, I guess. But from what I was told, like when you get into Alabama and I guess Georgia, it's, there is a noticeable, I guess, situation that's going on there still. It's interesting because like the North is like the wannabe South, I swear.
Where yeah, it is.
Like, Southern Ohio thinks they are from Alabama. Or Mississippi. I'm just like,
it's a strange changing dynamic. I think it's very fluid.
Yeah.
But very strange. It's taken a long time to really fully become aware of just how incredibly,
when people use the term whitewashed history, I mean, it makes sense. You know, you're only taught about Martin Luther King. You're not taught about how the system really impacted Martin Luther King and other black people and other minorities, you know.
Right. So
it's hard to be aware of things like that when you're not taught it.
Mm-hmm.
And honestly, I think that's one thing, like I can take that as an excuse too for like racism at some point, just because like I know people who are, they're good people at heart, but they just are ignorant. You know, like they just don't know what they're saying or what they think is like a sort of a racist thought.
Yeah. And I do think, you know, I love you guys' effort to just really put these conversations out there and have that available so that, like you said, like, so people don't have the option to be ignorant, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Ignorance now is becoming a choice rather than a default
state. It is. I totally agree there. I really do. And you know, obviously I'm a very laid back person. So it's hard to, I guess, offend me at some point. And then I guess maybe because of my background, because I've gone to very racist, like predominantly white schools, you know, I got along with everyone, but I've had friends that were very, I guess, Confederate.
Oh, geez.
Yeah. But like, they're the type of people that they'll just be like, yeah, you know, you're not like other black people. You're actually cool. You know, they'll say stupid stuff like that.
Right. Work and, you know, making people aware of diversity and inclusion issues within fisheries are both obviously really, really important, and we really love them. But what are some things that you like to do outside of work when you're not working?
Yeah, that's a great question. So outside of fisheries, I definitely always like to fish. So I like to go carp fishing. It's a lot of fun, and I highly encourage all of you to look into
We're going to
it.
learn more about it, I think, in
Yes.
a few weeks. I think we're going to
We
do an
can talk
episode all about methods that people use that we like to use for fishing.
for
So.
just fishing. Yeah, we can definitely talk more about that. But and to keep it simple, that is one of my favorite things to do outside of work. I'm also a big video game player, so I love playing Xbox. I've been a big gamer for a long time, so I'll play whenever I can. Like, things have changed now that I'm an adult. You just can't play all day anymore, unfortunately. I used to be big into baseball, so I had to like balance those two out. But so it's fishing, Xbox, and then my most recent hobby is muscle cars, which
That's very Ohio.
yeah, I mean, well, see, that's why I like the South, because when you go down there, I mean, everyone's got, a V8 something, like. So I love my cars. I have a Mustang that I love to joy ride around. I guess it is very Ohio, driving around. That's all we got to do. But yeah, I mean, I just like that stuff. I like performance stuff, like performance cars. I like engine building. Like, when I talk about cars, like, I don't like to just look at them. Like, I do mechanical stuff. And I picked that up because it is expensive to pay a guy to do the stuff for you. So I've learned to do my own things. So those things keep me busy outside of fisheries.
Well, in the mechanical stuff, you can't really overstate the importance of that when you're doing fisheries work, especially
It
field work.
is. Yes. And it has, I'm telling you, it has definitely contributed to like field work, because you get a sense of how things work, whether it's an engine or not. Like, you have to worry, you're using tools, and in fisheries, you might not realize it, to those that are listening, I guess, and don't know this, but I mean, in fisheries, you kind of gotta be a handy person at some point. Like, there might be a time where you need to fix something on the boat, or at the office, or something needs fixed, or sampling equipment gets concoct to work to do the sampling. So
Now the tough part of the interview is over, and it's on to my final questions. So first, what do you think is your favorite fish?
man, that's such a tough question. I'm just kidding. It is easy. For me, the common carp, I will have to say, is my favorite fish. Just think about those nice golden scales and in that sucker mouth that they have. There, well, it's like all the variants with the common carp. Like, you have the mirror carp, which have big scales that are like selected all over the body, or you can have them like beautifully run, like symmetrically, all like right across, I guess, like a lateral line down the side, the fish's side, and that's the only place they have those scales. Like, it looks so cool. It's just such a cool looking fish. Koi are always awesome. Such diverse colors. So yeah, it's a trash fish here, but in Europe it's not. So I'm gonna be European on this one.
Hey man, perfect. Common carp. What is your dream job or location?
So definitely my dream job is to be a fisheries biologist. Hopefully
Check, you already are. Good job.
almost, I guess. I mean, yeah, I'll say almost. I don't want to give myself the credit until at least when my master's is over, because I still feel like there's plenty for me to learn.
There's always plenty to learn.
Yeah, I say that's my dream job. I hope that's not shooting too low. I think that's pretty high standard for me.
I think that's fantastic. I mean, and especially you know, if you're already doing it and you're already on the path, that's fantastic. I mean, how many people can really say that?
Dream location, that's a hard one for me, because it varies. I don't know. Part of me wants to live in Texas, just random. And I mean, I don't.
They have fish there. I don't really
know. Huh?
They have fish there.
Yeah, I've assumed they have decent, fish management going on there, I guess. Huh. I mean, there's plenty of
PW is pretty good.
Yeah, yeah. So, Texas, if Michigan wasn't so cold, it would probably be Michigan. I'm not a big winter person.
They do have good lakes.
They do. I mean, they have so much inland waters, too, so,
mm-hmm.
You know. And then you're on, three watersheds of the Great Lakes? What is it? Superior, Michigan, and Erie. So, mm-hmm.
And Huron.
Yep. Yeah. And hell. Oh, I might have to cut that up. And Lake St. Clair is also in there. So
mm-hmm.
Either Texas or Michigan, I guess.
And finally, if there was one point or principle you would have programmed into everyone's head, what would it be?
So one of the things that I like to believe in yourself and to actually believe or know that you can do what it is that you're after or trying to do. So for me, you know, I think the biggest challenge is becoming someone that does research for a living. I mean, come from the background I've come from, and I guess to throw it out there too, like coming from out of the African American community, I mean, it's just not, this area of work is just something that you typically is not brought up in the house, and not for any bad reasons. It's just not popular, I guess. So, to me, it's difficult a little bit. And the only way one of the ways that helps me get through, you know, hard things when you're doing harder things, and I guess becoming an adult, is to just believe in yourself, having that confidence that you can tackle the upcoming projects or events. So, yeah, if I could just get everyone to think that, because it's always upsetting. I've heard this so much in college amongst my peers, like when a test comes up or any kind of big opportunity, people they get intimidated and they don't perform their best because they don't think they can do it. And they're pretty much speaking into existence that they can't do it by thinking that way, I guess. So,
well, Dion, thank you so much for being a guest on the show. I really have had a great time chatting with you. If people wanted to connect with you online or learn more about your work, where can they find you?
You can look me up on Instagram.
Okay.
That's at Dion Carping.
Sweet.
So you'll see
get some carp pictures.
Yeah. Yep.
Thank you, everyone, for listening to this 91st episode of the Fisheries Podcast. If you'd like to get a hold of me, you can find me on Twitter at FishVecchio. The podcast is Fisheries Pod on Facebook at facebook.com/fisheriespodcast, or even drop us a line on old-fashioned email, feedback@thefisheriespodcast.com. I hope you enjoyed this episode. You can download past, present, and future episodes on your favorite listening app, or stream it from Spotify or thefisheriespodcast.com. And don't forget to head on over to our Patreon page and support the podcast if you feel so inclined. I'm Julie Vecchio. Thank you for listening to this episode of the Fisheries Podcast. And remember, believe in yourself.